You can buy it. Today you can buy a flag for $40.
Okay, let's begin. I think this is going to be our last class before a break for Rosh Hashanah season. Because next week I'm trying to essentially
get ready for the
okay.
See, this is our
We're in the middle of our comparison between the birth of Shimshon and the birth of Shmuel, a comparison which is important for us. Probably won't bring it to a conclusion today, but it's certainly important for us because the parallel is too striking to be arbitrary or to be an accident. We have the two barren mothers, the birth of a child who is designated for some broader, greater mission, the story, both of whom are shoftim. Shmuel is a shofet, Shimshon is a shofet. In fact, Shmuel is the next shofet after Shimshon. So they're in sequence. Both are nazirim. Both are, and in fact, I just gave out a source page. Which is source number one is the Mishnah in Nazir, which I mentioned last class or two classes ago. I didn't actually give you the source page for it, but it's the Mishnah Nazir Hayash, Mishnah in Tractate Nazir, Nazir Hayash Shmuel. That Shmuel was a Nazir because of the textual parallel to Shimshon. Both are unique Nazirim, meaning they are Nazirim from birth, which is a unique status called Nazir Shimshon. Shmuel is also in that regard. Moralo Yaleh Rosho. Both by designation from pre-birth, in the case of Chana and Shmuel by the mother, in the case of Shimshon by the Malach. So it's too striking a parallel to be arbitrary. And so we started to explore the Shimshon component, the Shmuel component of it, in the hope that it would bring us back to the Shimshon story and understanding of it a little bit more. Today I hope will be our last focus on the story of Shmuel, which will then bring us back to Shimshon. Where I left off, I don't remember where I left off. Anybody have a clue where I left off?
We did a lot of comparison.
He's got good notes. The last thing I said. What was the last thing we did?
We talked about all sorts of problems.
We talked about Shmuel as who fights the Plishtim, but in a sense completes the job that Shmuel began, that Shimshon began. He fights the Plishtim, removes the existential threat of the Plishtim, whereas Shimshon is designated to Yachel Lohoshiat Yisomiyat Plishtim to begin. And so not only does the story of their births parallel, but their mission and mandate seem to have a certain parallel to them as well. I believe the last thing I said was that the key to understanding Shmuel's birth, we also have questions about Chana. Why does she want the child? Why does she offer to give the child back to God? What kind of a purpose is that? What kind of a dream is that, to have a child just so she can prove to Pnina that she can have a child too, but after that she doesn't need the child, she's going to give it to the Beit HaMikdash? We have no precedent for such a concept. All the questions that we asked. And I think that we suggest, I sort of left you off with a kind of a, dropped a sort of a trial balloon at the end of the class, which was that the key to understanding Chana's story lies in two words. Which two words am I referring to? So if you go back to Chana's tefillah, if you will, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Right at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Right. When she walks into the Beit HaMikdash to pray for a child, Vatitpalel al Hashem uvachot tivkeh, she prays to God, she cries. Vatidor neder vatomar, she takes an oath. And in this oath she says, Hashem tzvaot, imraot tireh bo'ani amatecha, uzchartani v'lo tishkachat amatecha, v'netatala amatcha zera anashim, what's her oath? Divide it into pieces. Perek Aleph Pasuk Aleph. What's her oath? She starts Hashem Tzvaot, God of hosts, whatever that means. If you will see the affliction, right, she's suffering. If you will see the affliction of your maidservant, remember me, don't forget me. Give me seed, man, child, zera anashim. Result will be, I will give him back to you, and he'll be a nazir. That's her oath. You give me a child, I give him back to you. And we saw at the end, she names the child Shmuel, and she refers to him as kihishiltiu lahashem, one who I have lent to God or borrowed from God, however you want to describe the Sha'ul Me'asha. And I suggest that the key to understanding Chana lies in two words. And they are Hashem Tzva'ot. Why is that extraordinary? So now, this is where...
This is the first time.
Right, so this is where... This is where the power of Chazal in the Midrashic literature of interpretation of text, the power of Chazal is that they had a perception of Tanakh that it's so hard for us to comprehend because they knew Tanakh by heart, backwards, forwards, inside, outside, and back, and in every direction. They were a walking encyclopedia of a concordance of every phrase and every word that appears in Tanakh. What we have computers to do today, they had just by familiarity with the text. So if you take a look at the Gemara in Brachos, which is source number 2, Chazal make an astounding assertion, which, if you're reading the Gemara and if you learn it from the in the flow of the Gemara, you have to somewhat take it for face value and take it for an element of trust, unless you can go back and check check the veracity of the statement. Chazal say, "Vatidor neder vatomar Hashem tzvaot, Amar Reb Elazar, miyom shebara Kadosh Baruch Hu et olamo, from the moment of creation until today." Lo haya adam shekra'o l'Kadosh Baruch Hu tzva'ot ad shebata chana v'kara'ato tzva'ot. From the moment of creation until this moment, no human being has ever called God tzva'ot, whatever that word means, we'll see in a second, until chana. Now, what I'm assuming that means is that the first time the phrase Hashem tzva'ot appears in Tanakh would be here. And that requires some verification. Now, I actually did this by computer, because I unfortunately don't have that ability to just say, okay, go through Tanakh in your mind's eye. And I found a couple of interesting things. The phrase Hashem Tzva'ot appears in Tanakh as a name of God, as a description of God. God Shem Tzvaot, God of hosts, appears in Tanakh 260 times. It's ubiquitous. It's as common as Hashem Elokim, Kel Shakai, all the various formulations or types of names that we attribute to God. One of them is Hashem Tzvaot and appears in many places. Take a look, for example, beginning of Perek Tetvav of Shmuel Aleph, just since we're in Shmuel Aleph. Um, beginning of Perek Tetvav, beginning of the Battle of Amalek. Vayomer Shmuel El Shaul. Shmuel, again, so once Shaul has become king, so I'm jumping to the head of the story. Oti Shalach Hashem Limshachacha Lemelech Al Amo Yisrael. God sent me to anoint you as king over Israel. Now listen to the voice of God's command. Ko ama Hashem tzvaot. Pekadati et asher asa Amalek
liYisrael. We translate the word literally host.
I don't know how we translate it yet. I will translate it shortly, but right now I'm just. That's how it, most translations have it.
It's always host. That's a literal.
Whatever what that word means, that we'll have to see, right?
It's
as mysterious as anything, and it's plural. It's for sure plural, right? The Hebrew is plural. Tzvaot.
That's why I was, yeah.
Right? We're gonna talk about the meaning in a second. I just want to understand what Chazal is suggesting to us, that the phrase appears many times in Tanakh. From this point forward, it's commonly used. Before Chana. Declaration Hashem Tzvaot, the phrase appears only once. No. If it was in Breshit, Chazal would have a problem. If it was in Breshit, Chazal would have a problem, because then you wouldn't be able to say the Chana was the first person to ever use this phrase. Right? It's almost as if Chazal is saying the Chana coined this phrase, which is really remarkable. The phrase appears only once, and the place is. You saw it. We saw it together. No. Nope. But we're getting closer. Take a look back in Perek Aleph at the beginning of the Perek. In Shmuel. Perek Aleph. Pasuk Gimel. Ve'ala ha'ishahu mi'irom yamim yamima. From describing Elkanah's annual pilgrimage to the Mishkan. He would go up each year to the Mishkan, lishtachavot v'lizbach laHashem tzvaot b'shilo. To bow to Hashem tzvaot in Shilo. So, was I right or wrong?
Right.
Why were they right? It says in Perek Gimel.
This is just the writer tell. This is not somebody using the phrase. This is a description of what Eli did. It's not.
Right. So now, on the one hand, Chazal say that the first person to articulate the phrase in usage is Chana. Here is the narrator, the Navi, the author of the Sefer, speaking. Number one. And number two, the very fact that Chana refers to God as Hashem Tzvot in the story, and it's such a central motif to what she's praying about, as we're going to see by the end of the Shir today, that's why I believe it's included in the beginning of the story. In other words, I could have picked any name for God at the beginning of the story. But the name that's chosen in the authorship of the story, in hindsight, is Dafka, the name that Chana coins and introduces, because to her, it's the central motif of what this story is all about.
Doesn't that beg the question? How did Chana come up with
it? That's exactly the issue. I'm not sure that Chana didn't coin it, meaning could have invented it, could have been the first person to declare it as such. The question is what does this phrase mean that it would have made sense for Chana to make this declaration? That's really the question. What significance does the phrase have for us? In the case of Chana, Chazal go one step further. They said not only does she articulate the phrase, but let's also talk about what the phrase means for her. So Chazal describe her intention in two sources. One is the continuation of this Gemara in Brachos, which unfortunately, I do not know why, I did not include in the rest of the on this source page here. It got cut off somehow. So I will tell you what the Gemara continues to say. So here I'm going to continue the Gemara in Brachos, which is you have a source too. You don't have the rest of this, so I'm going to read it, translate it, and you'll just listen orally, which is how the oral Torah was originally transmitted. Amra Chana lifnei Kadosh Baruch. This is her now. This is the Chazal's understanding of what Hashem Tzavaot means. Why would she have introduced her prayer with this phrase? First of all, what does the word mean? What does the word Tzavaot mean?
Armies.
Armies, correct. Capital Z? Yeah, it's in many sources, it's considered a name of God, which is why you'll hear many people say, for example, not Hashem Tzvaot, but Hashem Tzvakot, because they're assuming it's a name of God. In fact, that's what Chana seems to say, Hashem Tzvakot. The question is it a name of God, or is it an adjective? Right? Is it a name, a proper name for God, or is it an adjective describing God? Like we would say, Harachaman. God is compassionate. When we say the compassionate one, Rachaman, that's not a name of God, that's a description of God. And we're allowed to say it. Is Tzvaot a description of God or a name of God? That's ultimately the question. And it's a machloket. Even if we assume it's a name of God, it's Midrabanan understood that way. Certainly not Minatov. Either as it may, what does the word itself mean? Comes from the plural of Tzva. The word tzava in Tanakh is a very common word. Kol yotzei tzava b'Yisrael, all who go out to war in Israel. The galim I set up about, based on the census of the age of kol yotzei tzava. Tzava is a term that appears throughout Tanakh. It means an army. Hence the translation of Hashem Tzvaot as God of hosts, because host is a very fancy term for an army.
There's no right. And the other point is, host is never considered a descriptive word like compassion or mercy or something like that.
Well, that's what we're going to have to understand. What is the description here when we talk about God as God of hosts? What are we describing? That's essentially the question. So why is it the relevant name for her prayer? Right, that's the question I'm going to answer at the end of the shiur today. So we're going to take a journey through the world of this phrase. And we're going to come back to Chana's tefillah, and that will connect us back to the world of Shmuel. The phrase actually has an earlier application. The only time it's ever, prior to Chana's usage, the only other time it's ever described as related in some way to God, is in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. In Parshat Beshalach, Parshat Bo. I'll tell you in a second. Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Mem Aleph. Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Mem Aleph. Vahi, Miketz, Shloshim Shana Ve'arba Meot Shana, at the end of 430 years. Vahi Be'etzem Ayom Azeh, on that day, Yatzu Kol Tzivot Hashem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Translate, all of the armies of God, hosts of God, left Egypt. So the only other place where we have the phrase tzava in the plural as a description connected to God is in the phrase tzivot Hashem, which is very different from Hashem tzivot. It's the exact opposite phrase. What does tzivot Hashem mean?
The armies of Hashem.
Referring to?
Israel.
No.
No.
No. The Moshav B'nai Yisrael, Yiberet Yisrael, Abba Miot Shana, Ve'hi Ve'achre, Shloshim Ve'abba Miot Shana, Yatsu Kol Tzivot Hashem Me'eret Mitzrayim. Who are we talking about? B'nai Yisrael. get too existential on me yet. We'll get we'll get there in a few minutes, but not quite yet.
Tzivot
Hashem.
I always say.
Tzivot Hashem is a phrase that refers to Bnei Yisrael. We are the armies. The hosts also a term that's used to describe a multitude of people. And a multitude of people. So Tzivot Hashem emerged from Israel from Shibud Mitzrayim after 430 years. Chana, in a sense, reverses this phrase. Not Tzivot Hashem, but Hashem Tzvaot. The difference being that Tzivot Hashem means the armies of God. Hashem Tzvaot means God of the armies. Reverses the phrase. So here's what Chana says according to the Gemara in Brachas. Amar Chana lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam. Mikol tzva'ei tzva'ot shebarata bi'olamecha. Of all of the various myriads of armies of hosts of people that you created in the world, kashe b'enecha shetiten li ben achad. Is it too difficult for you to give me one son? How many millions upon millions of armies do you have? All I want is one. Then he Come on, gives a parable. Mashal amad dovav domel lemelech basav adam shasas sudal avadav. An earthly king made a big feast for his servants, and a poor man came knocking at the door. Ba ani echad v'amad al petach. Amar lehem tnuli prusa achat. He said to the servant who opened the door, "I just want a morsel of bread." V'leishkichu alav, and the servant who opened the door said, "Sorry, no can do." Dachak v'nichnas etzel ha-melech. So this poor man just bashed through the door and ran into the king. Amar lo Adoni ha-melech, mikol suda shasita, kasher b'necha liten li prusa achat. You have a feast here for kings and princes. One piece of bread is all I ask for. Hashem tzvaot, you have many, many, many people in this world, armies upon armies. All I ask for is
one person.
So says the Gemara. And again, in an attempt to do two things, understand the phrase Hashem Tzvaot on the one hand, and on the other, to understand why Chana coins this phrase in the context of her prayer. But according to the Gemara's application, the word Tzvaot means refers to people. And why is it in the plural?
Because you can't have one people.
She's not referring to nations. She's referring to
collective noun.
Correct.
Individuals.
Right. She's referring to the notion that God has. There's so many people in this world. Armies upon armies of them. Tzvaot upon tzvaot. Tzivet tzvaot. All I'm asking for is one child. Hashem Tzvaot, God of human beings, God of humanity, we would say in today's terminology. So in that context, it's a very earthly term, matches in some way, the application of the phrase in Sefer Shemot, Tzivot Hashem, is referring to Bnei Yisrael. Hashem Tzvaot means God of humanity, the world of human beings. There's another version of this story that appears in a different midrashic source called the Psikta Rabbati. The reason I quote them both is because they have very different interpretations of the word Tzvaot, and the Mefarshim quote both. Rashi, I gave you a couple of examples from the Mefarshim Radak, but the Mefarshim quote both. Says the Psikta Rabbati, this takes us in a different direction. This you have, source 5. Vatidor neder vatomar Hashem Tzvaot. Mao Hashem Tzvaot. What does this phrase mean? Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon. Amra chana lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam. Yesh tzava lemalo, v'yesh tzava lemato. God, you have an army on high, and there's an army down below. Meaning there are two systems of servants or those who claim loyalty to God, earthly human beings and divine beings of some kind. However, they are very different. Hatzava shel ma'ala, the heavenly army, the heavenly hosts, einam lo ochlim v'lo shotim v'lo parim v'lo rabim v'lo metim alachayim le'olam. What's the characteristic of the heavenly domain? They don't eat, they don't drink, they don't multiply, they don't have any physical attributes, and they don't die. They're pure spirits, right? They live forever. V'yatzava shalamata ochlim v'shotim u'parim v'rabim u'metim. And the earthly armies are mortal. They eat, they drink, they are fruitful and multiply, and they die. Says Chana, you want to see the chutzpah of Chana, it's really remarkable. She says, V'eini yodat me'ezet tzava'ani. You've confused me, God. You haven't clarified for me from which army I belong. Why come? Why? Im mishal ma'ala o mishal mata. Am I part of the earthly army or am I part of the heavenly army? Im mitzava shal ma'ala ani, if I'm from the heavenly army, lo eye lo ochlim v'lo shotim v'lo molida. So if that's the case, I understand why I have not given birth, because the heavenly armies, they don't give birth. But that explains why I'm not eating or drinking, because they don't eat or drink either. V'lo meta, nor do they die. Ela chay li'olam. Kishem she'em chayim l'olam, then I should live forever. God, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell me I'm barren and therefore I'm part of the heavenly army and then expect me to eat, drink, and die. So if you want to say that I'm barren and therefore I'm part of the heavenly armies because I don't give birth, so fine, so I won't eat and I won't drink, and it's your responsibility to make sure that I don't die. V'im mitzvah shomata ani, but if I am mortal of the earthly court, earthly army, so then he'ochel et v'shotet, so I'll eat and drink, but then umolida, I need to give birth. And then I'll be just like everybody else. The chutzpah is remarkable.
Weren't there any other barren women at the time besides Chana?
There may have been, but that's Chana's. Right, the chutzpah of it is remarkable, right? She walks into the Beit HaMikdash and says, okay, God, we'll make a deal. I'll cut you a deal.
You see, as you read this to us, you know, we hear your intonation.
Right.
Chutzpah.
Well, I say that facetiously. I say that facetiously. I have only the greatest respect for Chana.
No,
I say that facetiously.
Your intonation
is the chutzpah of it. Yes. Correct. Correct. And there isn't a chutzpah involved. But the chutzpah is, yeah, it's a medrash. So, yeah, you expect them to have a Gemara cup because it's being written in the Gemara. But
commentary that you don't get that. I mean, I don't get it anyway from reading.
Correct.
The text. So, you only get a very, very humble, very devout woman.
Correct. So what really you need to do is you really need to figure out where Chazal saw what they're describing. What's the connection between what's in the text and what's in the Medrash? That's our task. When you learn a Medrash like this, part of the goal is not to see it as a standalone Midrashic story. This is the history of what took place, and we'll leave the text out of the picture. Don't confuse me with the facts for a moment. Right, that's not the agenda. The agenda is to take what the Medrash is suggesting in its very colorful story-like depiction, which is stylistic of Chazal's Midrashic approach to text, and understand where they derived it from the text. And the fundamental difference between the way the Gemara describes the phrase Hashem Tzvaot and the way the Psikta describes the phrase Hashem Tzvaot is, whereas in the Gemara understood Hashem Tzvaot as meaning God of human beings, humanity. In the Psikta, the phrase Hashem Tzvaot means
the heavenly host.
Two armies. Correct. Tzva shel Mala and Shomata. The rest of the story is the colorful filling in of the conversation. But the core distinction here is that she's introduced the notion that God of hosts means that there are two hosts involved, the heavenly and the earthly, and that God is the master of both. Hashem Tzavot. That, and that's truly, I think, the unique contribution of this phrase. And in fact, I think that that's how it's used in the rest of Tanakh. I would venture to say, if I had to apply the phrase, or to derive from the phrase, Hashem Tzavot, how it is used in its application throughout Tanakh, which is more correct, the Psikta's description or the Gemara and Brachas' description, I would say without question, it's the latter. And the phrase Hashem Tzvaot is a very unique phrase, and it has a particular meaning when it's used by the Nevi'im. And it's that meaning that I think Chana is referring to specifically, and that's essentially what Chazal are pointing to. She may have coined it, she may not have, but it's certainly the first time we see it in its application. What is the significance of this phrase as it is used and appears in the rest of Tanakh? I'll give you a couple of examples.
Is that why she could give her son what she did to her son? Because she didn't know exactly which world she was going
to
be?
No, I want to leave the Midrashic color to the story out of the picture for a second. Because I'll have a very exaggerating kind of way of filling in pieces. I think the core message of this medrash, if I had to take something from it, is not the chutzpah of her saying, I don't know which world I'm from. She knew exactly which world she was from. And she was not naive. Right? The message I think she's deriving from this is this novelty. This dual army that exists in the world and God's control of the world on two domains, heavenly and earthly. Why is that relevant to her story? I'll show you in a moment. I think it's very relevant to her story, but I want to show you the phrase, Hashem Tzvot.
Well, maybe her bakasha to Hashem was to say that, give me a child and my child would be from both.
Maybe she's combining both worlds in her child, or she doesn't say it that way. We'll come back to Chana. Let's come back to Chana. Let's first understand the phrase Hashem Tzvot, then we'll come back to Chana. I think it'll be very clear once we understand what this phrase means in context. Where else have we seen this phrase? Where are we familiar with it? There are so many places where it's used in Tanakh, but some of them are more familiar to us than others. Hashem Tzvot. Anybody know where the phrase rings in our ear from? I'll put a melody to it. It'll become a little clearer. All right, so listen to these psukim. Se'u she'arim v'sheichem. Sound familiar? Se'u she'arim v'sheichem. Lift gates, lift up your heads. V'inasu pitche olam. The doors of the world, open up. V'yavo melech hakavod. The king of glory come. Mize melech hakavod. Who is this King of Glory? I mean, Tehillim Chaf Dalet, for the record. Mize Melech HaKavod, Hashem Izuz. Well, we'll get to Hashem Tzvot in a moment. Hashem Izuz V'Gibor, strong and mighty. Hashem Gibor Milchama, God of War. Se'u She'arim L'Sheichem U'su Pitchei Olam V'Yavo Melech HaKavod. Mi uze melech hakavod? Hashem Tzvaot hu melech hakavod tzava. Hashem Tzvaot is equivalent in that passage in Tehillim to Hashem Izuz v'gibor Hashem Gibor Melchama. Think about the term. Makes sense, right? It's a military term. Hashem, when would you use the phrase Hashem Tzvaot if not a description of God's strength, mighty, warrior, Hashem Ish Milchama, Hashem Gibor Milchama, Hashem Yizuz V'Gibor, Hashem Tzvaot, God of hosts, God of armies, God who commands the armies. Which armies? which armies? Which armies are at God's command? Earthly armies or heavenly armies? When we are saying in Tehillim, Hashem, Uzuz v'gibor, Hashem gibor mechama, are we talking about God who commands the earthly army? Or are we talking about God who commands the heavenly army? Which are we talking about when we talk about Hashem, Melech, HaKavod? Unclear.
Why can't it be both?
It certainly can be both. That's my point. Right? It's unclear from the text, but I think it's from context, it certainly could be both. The notion of God commanding two armies, the army of Israel, the army of human beings, the army that bears the arms of war, and an army of heavenly domain, I think is an idea that appears in many places in Tanakh. Chana is the first one to give it a name. We saw it when we looked at the story of Devar and Barak. Remember the story of Devar and Barak and the war against Sisera? And the Navi turns to Barak and says to Barak, go now into the army that God is with you. And we ask the question, why is it that a Navi has to tell Barak when to begin the battle? Because a Navi has a perception that a human being doesn't have. And that perception includes the ability to understand and to perceive that God's military might assists in battle in parallel. This is not just an esoteric concept. This is a very concrete concept.
So does that give Chana more credibility?
We'll come back to Chana. I'll come back to Chana. I promise the end of the shiur today. We're a long way from coming back to Chana. I promise you we'll come back to Chana today. But first, because if I leave it in the world of an esoteric concept, divine providence, I haven't done it justice. It's more than divine providence. When we talk about God's army assisting in battle and helping divine, it's more than divine providence. It's a much more concrete concept than simply a function of providential assistance. I shared with you maybe before a little episode in Sefer Melachim, which I like to call my favorite episode in Tanakh, because I think it articulates, demonstrates this idea more than any other. If you turn to Melachim Bet, Perek Vav, for a moment. So we start to read it, you'll see. We've looked at it before. Melachim Bet, Perek Vav. Melachim Bet Perek Vav. Is it too hot?
Can we either open a window or a crack?
I can't have it both ways.
Oh, it's too hot, it's cold.
Me too.
It's
oh,
okay.
Oh my God. No, no, me too.
All right, I'll turn it down.
Well, you can't satisfy everybody. Forget it. One's hot, one's cold, one's cold.
All right. Melachim Bet.
Open up a window.
Just remember that everything you say is recorded on the and posted on the internet, and just remember. All right, Melachim Bet Perek Vav. What pasuk? That's a good question. That is a good question. Let's start. All right, let's start from the beginning of the story, which is pasuk Chet. The context here is not our issue. The context here, we're jumping into a different time warp, different time period. Elisha, as the Navi, post Eliyahu, the king of Aram, is waging war with the king of Israel. The context is less relevant than the story itself. Melech Aram haya nilcham b'Yisrael, king of Aram, was waging war against Israel. He would bring his army and he would say to his advisors, okay, where should we take the army to fight against Israel? And the soldiers would say, his generals would say, okay, the best place to attack would be here. Fine. They would go there. In the meantime, Isha Elokim, what does Isha Elokim refer to? The Navi. Would say to the king of Israel, "Hishamer mi'avod ha'makom hazeh, don't go there. Why? Ki sham Aram nechitim. Because that's where Aram is laying ambush for, is laying in wait for you. In other words, the king of Aram can't get a break here. Every time in secret he moves his army to a new location, the king of Israel knows exactly where his army is, because he has the best satellite intelligence system in the world. He's got the Navi. It's better than every spy satellite you can imagine. So the story continues. He would go there and he would find that Israel is waiting for him, and he can't handle this. So finally, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayisa'er lev melech Aram al hadavar hazeh. The king of Aram is angry at this. Vayikra levadav vayomer alehem, alo tagidu li mi mishalanu amelech Yisrael, tell me who's my spy. Which one of you is spying for the king of Israel? Vayomer achat mi'avadav, lo adoni amelech. So one of his servants said, my king, you've got it all wrong. We're not spying for you. Ki Elisha ha-Navi asher b'Yisrael yagid le-melech Yisrael et ha-dvarim asher tedaber b'chadai mishkavecha. You don't get it. They have a Navi. His name is Elisha. And he can tell the king of Israel anything that you whisper in the secrecy of your bedchambers. There are no secrets from the Navi. So then he says, fine, go and take him out. Go shoot down the spy satellite. Go take out Elisha. So they send, in Pasuk Yudalid, Vayishlach Shama Susim V'Rechev V'Chayil Kaved. They go to attack Elisha. He's one man, and he sends, the king of Aram sends to attack Elisha, Sus V'Rechev V'Chayil Kaved Ma'od. Horses and chariots and soldiers. He sends an entire platoon with tanks and with you name it to go and take out Elisha. Obliterate, nothing to be left. They come in the middle of the night, they surround Elisha's house. In the morning, Vayashkem Mesheret Isha Lokim Lakum. In the morning, Isha Elokim's servant, his Mesheret, his right-hand man, his disciple. We happen to know who Elisha's disciple is. He's a man by the name of Gehazi. We haven't encountered him yet, but anyway, his disciple gets up in the morning, I assume to go and get the morning paper, walks out the door, Vayetzei, v'hinei chayil sovevet ha'ir, v'sus v'rechev, and he sees an entire army surrounding him, horses and chariots. In the middle is Elisha and his servant. Now he's in trouble. Vayomer naro elav. The nar, this lad, the Mesheret, comes running to Elisha and says to him, Aha, Adoni, eichan na'aseh. Whoa, my master, what are we going to do? Now, you are Elisha. Put yourselves in Elisha's shoes for a moment and turn to your lad and tell him words of comfort that will reduce the tension and lower his fears. Right? Lower the stress. What does he say? What should he say? I would imagine he would say something like, don't be afraid, God is with us, we'll take care of it, we'll pray, God will send a miracle, he'll help us. Vayomer, Elisha says, Al tira, don't be afraid, ki rabim asher itanu me asher otam. Don't be afraid, we outnumber them. Doesn't say anything about God. He just says, don't worry, we outnumber them. Horses, chariots, thousands of soldiers, chel kaved ma'od, Elisha and Gehazi. We outnumber them. If you are Gehazi, what do you do now?
Run.
Run. My master has lost it.
There's only two of us and all of them.
There's two against all of them. So now his tefillah begins. Vayitpalel Elisha. Elisha begins to daven. What do you think Elisha davened for? If you were Elisha, put yourselves in Elisha's shoes, what would your tefillah be? deliver us, save us, send us a miracle, Ana Shemoshiana, Ana Shemot, something, right? No. What does Elisha daven? Vatipalel Elisha v'yomar, Hashem, p'kachna et enav v'yireh. God, open up his eyes that he may see. Elisha doesn't have any fear. All he asks for is that God should open up Gehazi's eyes, like the donkey of Bilam, who could see that which Bilam could not. Elisha can see that which Gehazi cannot, and so his entire tefillah is, let him see. And guess what? Vayifkach Hashem et einei hanar. He opened up his eyes, and what did he see? Vayar v'inei hahar male susim v'rechev esh. Svivot Elisha. He opened up his eyes and he saw the mountain was filled with horses and chariots of fire, surrounding and protecting Elisha. In other words, it's not the first time we've seen chariots of fire in the story of Elisha. Eliyahu goes up to Shemayim on a chariot of fire. Elisha, that was only one, right? So that was, I guess, the general, the Sar Tzva Hashem. It's not the first time we've seen the concept of a Tzva Hashem coming to the assistance of Israel. The first time we actually see this notion explicitly, that when Israel goes into battle, there are malachim who go with them. Actually, not the first time. We'll come back to, we're going to work our way backwards. But one of the most explicit times is the Battle of Jericho. Yeshua stands at the entrance to Jericho, and what does he see? Yeshua stands, you don't have to turn the page, I'll just, it's one pasuk, I'll read it to you. Yeshua stands at the Battle of Jericho, and he sees Vayhi biyot Yeshua biyericho, as Yeshua is standing at Yericho about to engage, vayisa einav vayar, he lifts up his eyes and he sees, v'nei ish omed lenegdo, and he saw a man standing there, v'chabo shlufa biyado, with a sword drawn. Yeshua goes over to him, vayelech alav Yeshua vayomer lo, halanu atayim letzareinu, and he says to him, are you for us or against us, friend or foe, who are you? Vayomer lo, he says to him, no, I'm neither friend nor foe. Ki ani, I'll tell you the phrase, ki ani sar tzva Hashem. I am the officer of the army of God. Atabati. You're going to fight Yericho, I'm here to help. The notion that there is this tzva Hashem that comes to our assistance is much more than just a function of some esoteric concept of divine providence. In Tanakh, there's a description of an army of malachim with an entire structure, a Sar Tzva Hashem, a general that commands the army of God. The Nevi'im saw these malachim, they commanded these malachim, they instructed them, they went into battle together with them. Devorah goes into battle together with Barak. Barak's commanding the earthly army, and Devorah is commanding the heavenly army. Min HaShemayim Milchamu Basi. Milchamu. That's the whole point of this combination, Hashem Tzvaot, is that there is this notion of a synthesis between the earthly army and the heavenly army. It's not just a function of divine providence, there's actually two armies functioning together. Another place where you see it explicitly, Yaakov, on his journey out to the house of Lavan, he has a dream. And what does he see in the dream? Remember the dream, the ladder? Right, what does he see in the dream? He sees Malachim going up and Malachim going down. So what does Rashi say? Malachim of Eretz Yisrael are going up, Malachim of Chutz Laaretz are going down. Nobody ever asked the question, who are these Malachim? Why do I need Malachim in Eretz Yisrael and why do I need Malachim in Chutz Laaretz for? I got Malachim in Eretz Yisrael going up and Malachim for Chutz Laaretz coming down. So who are they? And the answer is, I've got an army. Yaakov is going into war. He's got to go to war with Esav. He's got to go to war with Lavan. He needs protection. So accompanying him in his protection is God's army, is Tzva Hashem, is Malachim. In Eretz Yisrael, he's got one set of Malachim, and in Chutz Laaretz, he has a different set of Malachim. And the Nevi'im saw them, and the Nevi'im interacted with them. part of the power of what the Nevi'im, of who the Nevi'im were. There's a fascinating verse at the end of Parshat Vayetze. Yaakov is coming back from Lavan's house. At the beginning of Parshat Vayetze, he goes out to Lavan's house and he sees this dream of the angels going up and down in the, on the ladder. We miss the end of the story. The very end of Parshat Vayetze, Yaakov is coming home, knowing that he's about to meet, cross the border and go into the land of Israel and meet Esau. And at the end, the last pasuk says, right. As he has his whole pact with Lavan, he leaves Lavan, the beginning of Perek Lamed Bet, Vayelech Vayeshev Lavan Limkomo, Lavan goes home, V'Yaakov Alach L'Darko. Yaakov continues his journey to the land of Israel. Coming home now. Last pasuk of Vayetze. Vayifgu'u bo malachei Elokim. He meets malachim. Vayifgu'u bo malachei Elokim. Vayomer Yaakov. We're not at the battle yet. The battle is next in Parshat Vayishlach. Vayomer Yaakov kasher ha'am. When Yaakov saw these malachim, he said, Machane Elokim ze. Machane Elokim ze. What's a machane? A camp. What kind of camp? Military camp. No such thing as summer camp in Tanakh. It's a military camp. Machane Elokim ze. Because he saw malachim. This is Tzva Hashem. Then he says something remarkable. They crush him in Makom Hahu. He names the place Machanayim. And what does Machanayim mean? It's a double camp. Why is it in the plural? Because I've got an earthly army and a heavenly army. Machanayim is essentially equivalent to Hashem Tzvaot. That's the equivalency. Now, how does all this relate to Chana? How does this relate to Chana? So we have all these mysterious questions about Chana. Why does she want a child? What does she want to do with this child? Why does she offer this child to be a Nazir? Why does she start her tefillah with the word Hashem Tzvaot? The key to Chana is her tefillah. Tefillat Chana. Remember Tefillat Chana? Tefillat Chana is not when she asks for a child. Tefillat Chana is when she comes back with the child and she gives him to the Kohen, she gives him to the Beit HaMikdash, and she says, this is the child I prayed for, and she begins a prayer. And in that prayer, she finally lets out, pours out her heart, and tells us exactly what's been irking her all these years. And it's not about having a child. If you take a look at, and this is really where the story, I think, will come clearest. If you take a look back in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Bet, beginning of Perek Bet. Vatitpalel Chana v'tomar. Chana begins to pray. She offers the following prayer. Now, there's a lot of phrases in this prayer that are ambiguous or hard to understand, but just the tone is really what I want you to understand. V'tomar. In fact, I'm going to write down the key words that she uses. Alatz libi ba'ashem. My heart rejoiced, or rejoices. Ramak karni b'Hashem, my crown, rejoices in with God. Rachav pi al oivai, my mouth has been widened over my enemies. Ki samachti b'shuatecha, I rejoice over your salvation. Now the word Yeshua, I have to be careful with the word Yeshua. Somebody asked me this the other day. The word Yeshua, we translate as salvation. We have to be very careful not to misinterpret the word.
Is it physical?
Right. Yeshua in Tanakh always means physical. Salvation from an enemy that is attacking, from a danger that is imminent. Now, it can be a physical danger in terms of an army. It can be a physical danger in terms of an illness. It can be a physical danger in terms of financial crisis. But it's always something physical, tangible, earthly. The notion of a spiritual, quote-unquote, salvation is a Christian term that has entered into the lexicon of English. And one has to be very careful with English terms, because the moment they get distorted, there are connotations and subtleties that we just associate with terms because of the English language. So the word Yeshua here refers to a victory over, in parallel, a victory over, see in a moment, but over, in the context of the tefillah, over her enemies, whoever they are. Ein kadosh kashem ki ein biltecha ve'ein tzur kelokeinu. There is none like you, O God. There is none holy like you. Al tarbut dabu gvoha gvoha. Etzei atak mipichem. Do not continue to speak haughtily, mightily. Ki el deot Hashem ve'lo nitknu alelot. God is a God of knowledge. God understands all things. Keshet giborim chatim, the bow of the warriors, you keshet giborim, the bow of warriors you have smashed, destroyed. V'nichshalim azu chayil, and those that have fallen have been given strength. Sveim balechem niskaru, those who were hung, who were satiated, are now starving. Ud evim chadelu, those who were hungry are no longer hungry. Ada kara yalda shiv'a v'dabat banim umlala, the one who is barren has seven, the one who has many children is sad. That Chazal say is a reference to Pnina. I'm going to skip that for now. Hashem memit umchaye, God causes to die, brings life. Morit sha'ol v'ya'al, memit umchaye. Morit Sha'ol, he brings down into the grave, brings out of the grave, reference to Triyat Metim. Hashem Morish Umashir, he causes to become poor, causes to become rich. Mashpil Af Miromem, brings down, brings up. In other words, God can reverse all trends and fortunes. Mekim Mi Afar Dal, those who are in the dust can be brought up. Me'ashpot yarim evyon, he can bring out of the dung heap, raise up the poor. Lo shivim nitivim, to sit them amongst the nobles. V'kisei kavod yanchilem, and give them a chair of glory. Ki la'ashem mitzukeret v'yashet alehem tevel. Ragle chasidav yishmor, the feet of his pious ones he guards. U'reshaim b'choshech yidam. And the wicked ones will perish in the darkness. Man's strength is not by koach, physical strength. Hashem yichatu mirivav, God will destroy his enemies. Alav b'shamayim yareem, Hashem yadin afsei aretz, v'yiten oz l'malko, v'yiten oz l'malko, v'yarem keren mishicho. Strength to his king, and raise the crown of his anointed one. She talks about enemies and victory over enemies. She talks about the bow of the mighty ones being broken. She talks about death and life, grave and living. She talks about the wicked who will be destroyed and the pious who will be victorious. She talks about God's enemies, and she talks about strength to the kings and crown to the anointed.
What's Karen Mashiachal?
They are, in fact, synonymous. A Mashiach is a king. Mashiach is anointed one. Kings were anointed. Who is she referring to? Who are Hannah's enemies to which she prays in this tefillah as a tefillah of thanksgiving that now the problem is solved? The enemy, the oyev, we will be victorious over. The keshet giborim will be broken. The wicked, the enemies, will all be subdued because strength will be given to his kings. Who is Hannah talking about?
Plishtim.
The Plishtim. No question. Israel is living under the subjugation of the Plishtim. Remember, the Plishtim have subjugated Israel for 40 years. An entire generation have been living under Plishtim rule. Shimshon manages to crack the surface, but he doesn't manage to inspire the people to tshuva, and he doesn't manage to inspire the people to respond. The first individual who will lead the people to tshuva and to respond to the threat of the Plishtim is Shmuel. And it's to Shmuel that she, it's for Shmuel that she prays. And the moment she's given this child, the moment she has Shmuel and she brings him back to the Beit HaMikdash, she offers a tefillah that essentially says, God, we're it. Now it's done. We've got the individual who will be the anointed one, or the, or will anoint the anointed one, it's unclear, but who will resolve the crisis of the Jewish people. Hannah's focus is not about the fact that she doesn't have a child. Hannah's angst, her pain, is not because she's unable to have children. Her pain is the pain of the Jewish people. Her pain is the fact that the Jewish people are subjugated under the foreign power of the Plishtim, and nobody's lifted a finger to do anything about it.
So is she considered Neviyah?
Absolutely, she's one of the seven Neviyot. And in her tefillah, what essentially is she, when she comes to the Beit HaMikdash the first time, and she sees the corruption of the Beit HaMikdash, she sees the corruption of the Mishkan, she sees the political state of the Jewish people, she sees the economic state of the Jewish people, she understands that Israel is caught in this moment of complete depravity and nobody's doing anything about it. So she walks into the Mishkan and she offers a prayer. And what's her prayer? She starts, Hashem Tzvaot. This isn't about me. This is about the army of Israel. This is about the identity of the Jewish people, their sovereignty, their status as an army of God, as an army of Israel. This is about the Chilul Hashem that's created in the world by the subjugation of the Jewish people and therefore the subjugation of God's army. Hashem Tzvaot, these are your army. So who's going to do something about it? Well, the last time we had somebody who tried to do something about it, his name was?
Shimshon.
And Shimshon was born to a barren mother to whom the Malach came and said, you know this, your child is going to be, you today are barren without child, you will have a child, and your child will be a Nazir min Abatan, Nazir from birth. And his mission will be? Shimshon, his mission will be? Who yachel lo shiat Yisrael miyad plishtim. Hannah walks into the Beit HaMikdash. We're still under plishtim rule. We're one generation later, because the story of Shimshon is followed by the story of Shmuel. The two stories in the middle are historically out of place. They're postscripts to the book of Shoftim, but they're not chronologically in sequence. The story of Shimshon is followed by the story of the Plishtim. In fact, many of the Mefarshim suggest that the 40 years of Plishtim subjugation and rule include the 20 years of Shimshon and the beginning of the rise of Shmuel. Hannah walks into the Beit HaMikdash and she looks at what happened with the Plishtim and she says, the precedent is there. Eshet Manoach, she was barren, she didn't have a child. Malach came to her and said, I'll give you a child, and I'll give you a child for the purpose of beginning to save Israel. I'll make him a Nazir. Evidently, you have to be a Nazir to save Israel from the hands of the Plishtim. So be it, says Hannah. But he didn't do it. He failed. Shimshon failed. And Shimshon failed for many reasons. It wasn't even clear that he was destined to succeed. But we're still here under the oppression of the Plishtim. That's Sefer Shoftim. That's Shmuel. That's how it begins. So what's her prayer? In one sentence? Give me a child. I volunteer him to be a Nazir like Shimshon. I volunteer to take the place of Eshet Manoach. You need a barren woman to have such a child? Fine, so I'll be the barren woman who bears such a child. He's mandated for a mission to you? I'll give him back to you. I don't need a child because I need to give birth. I need a child because Israel needs a Shimshon who's going to succeed and finish the job that Shimshon started. That's what she offers. I volunteer to raise a Shimshon who will get it right. The whole story of Shimshon is in the background mindset of Chana when she walks into that Mishkan. Her agenda is we need to finish the job that Shimshon started. If for that you need a barren woman who will raise a Nazir child and give him to you, Shimshon style, I volunteer. But we need to address this issue. That's what I think Chazal were referring to when they said that Chana coins the phrase Hashem Tzvaot. They were pointing to the fact that her vision was far broader than her personal agenda for a child. Her vision was on the destiny of the Jewish people. That was Chana. And that's why she's who she is and why she's the mother of Tefillah and the and one of the Neviot. That was Chana. But all of this, I chose to go through with you and learn primarily because it tells us the role that Shimshon had and the impact that Shimshon's story has on the generations to come. Bezrat Hashem, we will continue the story of Shimshon. A Nazarite? There's no translation. There's a transliteration, Nazarite. It means somebody refrains from, who holds back from. Because Nazir means to be separated from. So the it's someone who refrains from drinking wine in the ritual oath of a Nazir is called a Nazir.
So where are you going after?
Back to Shimshon. Because we have still two questions unanswered. Correct. We have still two questions unanswered. For both Chana, here are the two questions unanswered. Both for Chana and for Eshet Manoach and for Shmuel and for Shimshon. The two questions unanswered are, for this to work, why does the mother need to be barren? And why does the child need to be a Nazir? The two core questions. What I've shown you is that Chana understood that those are the two requirements. That the mother had to be barren and the child had to be a Nazir. Chana said, ditto. Let's do it again. But we haven't answered the question of why. I've just shown you the two dots on the line. Now we have to answer the question of why. Why is it necessary for the mother to be barren and the child to be a Nazir for this two formula to work? That's our agenda, B'ezrat Hashem, after the Chagim when we reconvene.